Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you tuned in this morning. In this first part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with biologist Edward O. Wilson. He is currently Pellegrino University Research Professor and Honorary Curator in Entomology of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. He grew up in Alabama, went to school at University of Alabama, then in 1955 went to Harvard and got his PhD there, and he has been there ever since. He has received many awards for his work, including the 1977 National Medal of Science. He's the author of two Pulitzer Prize-winning books, On Human Nature, published in 1978, and The Ants, published in 1990. He is, by training, an entomologist, a scientist who studies insects, and indeed did a lot of his early work on ants. He found that ants communicate using chemical substances known as pheromones. He also discovered that these insects indeed have what one might call a social caste system. He wrote a book that represented something of a change of direction in his interest in 1975, or it was published in 1975. That book, titled Sociobiology, A New Synthesis, which made a rather controversial argument that biology determines basic social behavior in humans and other animals. Some of his other books include, in addition to On Human Nature, Promethean Fire, Reflection on the Origin of the Mind. That book came out in 1983, and his most recent, which is titled Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge. That book first, I believe, was published in 1998, and then earlier this year came out in paperback, and it is published in paper by Vintage. So if you would be interested in reading the book, you can certainly do that. Our guest will be here in Champaign, Urbana, on the 18th of October to give a talk in the Millercom series, and was good enough to give us some of his time today to talk a little bit about some of his ideas and to give a kind of preview of that talk for folks who can't attend. We will be talking indeed about some of the ideas that you will find in his most recent book, Consilience. So as we talk with E.O. Wilson, you should certainly feel free to be a part of the conversation. All we ask of callers is that they try to keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving along and also accommodate as many different people as would like to call in. But, of course, anyone's welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number to call 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Wilson, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on board.
Perhaps you might, if you wouldn't mind, talk just a little bit about the basic idea of consilience.
Well, consilience is not a new idea. And the word itself is very old. It goes back to 1840 to the philosopher of science, William Whewell in England, who used it to designate what was then already clearly the trend in the natural sciences, namely the linkage across different disciplines by cause and effect explanation. And that's essentially what consilience is. It doesn't mean friendliness. It's spelled with an S, C-O-N-S. I-L-I-A-N-C-E, and it means literally a jumping together and designates what in fact has happened with increasing force in the natural sciences throughout the 20th century, a coming together of the major disciplines of the natural sciences, that is, chemistry linked to physics by causal explanation, biology to both of them. It is the mother's milk of the natural sciences, and today I think it's fair to say that it works in such force that chemistry has no clear boundary between it on one side and with physics, and on the other side with biology. And of course, all of this is commonplace to natural scientists, but what makes it new is the perception, and it's the one that I present in some detail in the book Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge, that the natural sciences have now approached the social sciences and the humanities close enough to make contact with them in a consilient manner. And we see this happening very dramatically in the 1990s and gaining force as the century closes in intermediate fields such as cognitive neuroscience, which is helping to explain in finer and finer detail how the brain works, in human genetics, including behavioral genetics, which we hope to see before very long, working through this new area within genetics of genomics, up from the macromolecules of the gene and transcription to the cells of the brain and then mental activity itself. And then evolutionary biology, including the field of sociobiology that you just mentioned, sometimes called evolutionary psychology, which is providing a reconstruction of the origin of human mental properties and a lot of social behavior in a way that is not easily grasped yet. And, of course, it's controversial.
That indeed, I think, is where people are going to have some trouble with the argument.
Nonetheless, I think that the prospects for new areas of scholarship and exciting new developments is there with these fields, and also with the fields in the social sciences that are taking the same direction, namely cognitive psychology and biological anthropology, and I think that this thinking is already having an effect widely in the social sciences and beginning to in the humanities.
Well, can you perhaps give an example of that effect, and can one indeed say that there, by making this link, this jump, that it is possible to, in some way, better understand human nature?
Sure. For one thing, we're getting a much better understanding of what human nature is. I think everyone agrees that human nature, if it exists, and most natural scientists and increasing numbers of social scientists and humanities scholars agree that it exists, that it's absolutely crucial in the social sciences, humanities, of human self-understanding to know what human nature is, and of course it also provides a challenging problem for the natural sciences, and I'll immediately tell you what human nature is. It is not the genes, and certainly it is not the cultural universal, such as incest taboo and rites of passage. The genes make it, or at least they have a lot to do in prescribing it, and the cultural universals are its products. The human nature is what is in between. It's what's called the epigenetic rules. And the epigenetic rules are the inherited, that is, biology or gene-based regularities in mental development. Now, this doesn't mean, as many people immediately think, that the picture is one of genetic determinism, or genes determining culture at the other end through human nature, that is, epigenetic rules. But I think, as most people would intuitively understand, the epigenetic rules, these propensities, which we are beginning to tease out and understand how they work, are biases in the way we see the world and the way we encode the experience and what we like, what we tend to do and the like, and that these inherited tendencies then interact with the evolving culture to produce the individual mind, and out of the collective individual mind, society and culture. The interesting part in all of this is that now as these borderland disciplines I just mentioned progress, we are beginning to understand precisely, in some cases, what the epigenetic rules are. And that opens a whole new domain of investigation, which should be of equal interest to natural scientists working on it, as well as social scientists and humanities scholars who will be working on it cooperatively as well. Mm.
Let me move and maybe make sort of a jump to the final chapter of the book, Consilience, and ask you to talk a little bit about some of the questions that you raise there, and they are indeed large questions. One of them being, do you think that human beings are continuing to evolve in significant ways, dramatic ways, or that what we are essentially now what we are going to be?
That depends, of course, on human choice. Right at the present time, the evidence suggests very strongly that we're not evolving in any particular direction or other. That is, we're not getting bigger brains as the centuries pass. We're not getting stronger limbs. We're not getting really the hereditary potential for a greater longevity, and so on. What's happening to the human species at the present time is that we are homogenizing. As the old geographic variants, or races they used to be called, are beginning to blend and blend rapidly, and the result is that there is less difference in the human genome as you go from one place in the world to the other. Conversely, there's a great deal more genetic variation in any one place, as, for example, any one city. That's where the human species is headed, homogenization. But then, right on the near horizon, because we're at the dawn of genetic engineering and the potential for germline gene replacement, there is the potential for volitional evolution. That is, evolution by design, by desire. And there probably will be a lot of change occurring in the next few decades as these techniques, either somatic tissue gene substitution, you know, to cure conditions like cystic fibrosis but without affecting the germline, or ultimately germline modification. There will be pressures not only to eradicate genetic diseases, of which there are thousands afflicting humanity, but also to try to modify normal, so-called normal genes, to give children more musical ability, more sports ability, whatever. When that day dawns, that this is a possibility, and people realize that there will be pressure, I think, to do it, and then we face one of the great dilemmas of history, having had evolution now placed in our hands. Will we take it and use it? Will we evolve in a new direction that we select? Will we allow that evolutionary curve of the free market of biomedical choice? Or will a kind of conservatism set in based on the view that our human nature, the aforementioned epigenetic rules, all of our emotions, our feelings, our desires, the basis of our fountainheads of our spirituality and so on, these being human, these are our essence. They're our humanity. Perhaps we will decide that that's what we will keep, and we will be conservative about it. And people have hardly started talking about this at all, even though I think it's on the near horizon, but I place myself in the camp of the conservatives. I tend to think that we will end up going very, very slowly on this.
Mm. Well, one wonders that if you think about the kind of modifications that are on the horizon, eliminating disease, for example, or perhaps even doing small things that might affect how people look. I mean, is that enough to initiate some kind of fundamental change in human nature? Aren't we talking about making changes that are virtually cosmetic in nature? Or is there some possibility that we have to say, well, you never really know what the outcome will be of anything that you change?
Let me put it this way. When You have a genetic disease, a clear-cut genetic disease, and these are being cataloged now and understood with increasing clarity. You have generally a kind of a knockout effect in which vital enzyme is distorted or removed so that you have a clear abnormal development. A child doesn't live beyond a certain age. There are severe mental impairments on due to a single gene. The road we can take safely is pretty clear cut. You get it restored, the gene that has been knocked out by the usually rare mutation. When you get to the cosmetic effect, that is actually trying to improve appearance or small increments in intelligence and so on, you are in uncharted and potentially treacherous waters, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. There are two things to keep in mind when dealing with genomics and genes and genomics, the broader field of the total study of all the genes acting together. And first, that most effects have multiple genes operating on them. In other words, this is a thing called pleiotropism. And if you modify one gene, you really don't know how the others are going to respond to that. And that leads us to the second and much more complex and risky aspect, and that is, I'm sorry, I call the first one pleiotropism. The first one is multifactorial or quantitative genetics. The second is pleiotropism, which is multiple effects. And this is something the present state of genetics can't tell us much about. We don't know what will happen if you start modifying certain genes by gene substitution. Even if you seem to be improving in, what appears to be a normal trait, you may be getting side effects that are not cannot be predictable. And I think most geneticists, even who work on fruit flies, would agree with that, that you really can't predict all the effects of substituting one gene for another, and these may be risky. It's rather comparable to using drugs to enhance or to suppress something in human physiology or behavior. We require a very strict period, in this country at least, of screening and testing before drugs are allowed on the market. And I think there'll be an equivalent in genetic engineering of humans anyway in the future. We'll want to be extremely careful before we get out onto that largely unexplored and quite treacherous field of genomics and genetic engineering of human traits. Hmm.
Our guest this morning in the first hour of Focus 580 is Edward O. Wilson. He's an entomologist, sociobiologist. He has been on the faculty at Harvard University for quite a few years. He currently is Pellegrino University research professor and also honorary curator in entomology of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. And he's going to be in Champaign-Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois on the 18th of October to talk about these and other issues as part of the MillerCom series, and that'll be open to anyone who would like to attend. More information certainly available. As you get close to that, you can check in on the MillerCom website. There'll be posters around the campus, I am sure. And, of course, some of the ideas that he has laid out here this morning, you can find in his most recent book, which is titled Consilience, the Unity of Knowledge, which is available now in a paperback edition published by Vintage, came out earlier this year. I think that you also seem to be making the argument that as we think about the future and the future of human beings, that you are suggesting, perhaps you're saying that you would like to see human beings, in a sense, sort of settle down and reacquaint themselves with their relationship with nature and perhaps start to be at least less dependent on technology or at least perhaps maybe think a little bit more about new technologies before adopting them. Can you talk about those ideas?
Yes, this has been one of the major concerns of mine for many years, and that is the state of the biosphere, this rest of life on Earth. That's the case that we are essentially wrecking the planet. We are changing the geophysical environment of the atmosphere and the soil, and even now increasingly the ocean itself, and we are eliminating species at a rate somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times faster than were eliminated before humanity came along. And the latter part is truly catastrophic in a long-term sense. We are impoverishing the world. And this is the background of the argument that I make out of consideration of consilience and what the natural sciences seem to be leading to as the correct self-image of humanity. That is, that we are a biological species. Some people say crudely, we are animals. Well, that's true. We're very special animals, but we are animals. We're a biological species. In a biological world, we're exquisitely adapted to this environment, not just the atmosphere, but we're adapted to the natural self-sustaining ecosystems that gave us birth and also supported us when we were less numerous and less active technologically. We are not only wiping out the natural environments that provide these free services and sustain us, but we are moving ourselves increasingly toward prosthetic adaptations to the altered biosphere. That is, we have to do more and more, for example, in maintaining croplands and purifying water that depend on massive technology. I'm not against high technology. I think we're going to have more and more technology and farther advance of the techno-scientific civilization, but we're going to have to do it in a way that settles humanity down before it wrecks the planet. And thus, many have said, are saying that now biology is the preeminent science. We are entering the century of biology in science. I'd like to put it more specifically and say we are entering the century of the environment, in which more and more of our energies and resources and genius should be put to the service of settling humanity down, saving as much of the biosphere as we can, and keeping humanity in a position where we don't have to depend on our ingenuity to maintain ourselves in an artificial world. We don't want really to turn this planet into spaceship Earth, where we're at the dials and levers and titration all the time just to keep ourselves alive.
Mm. I think that some people might argue, when we're talking about, you know, the fundamental nature of human beings, that human beings fundamentally have always been rather hard on the environment and have simply looked at it as a resource to be used, and that admittedly now we have the numbers of people so that that kind of attitude can really go much harder than it ever has, but that kind of maybe some people would argue that kind of rapaciousness is indeed part of our nature.
Well, I think it is. I believe that fundamentally we're human beings are ambivalent about the natural environment, and incidentally, parenthetically, this illustrates the great need for a branch of psychology that scarcely exists, which is environmental psychology, the study of our relationship, our mental, our psychological relationship to the environment, including the natural environment. And the reason for that ambivalence, I believe, is to be sought in our million-year Paleolithic history. When human beings in hunter-gatherer stage required all of the strength and rapaciousness they could muster to make a living in a world that was still largely wild. It had predators roaming at night. It had food scarcity that's developed automatically in ecosystems that did tend to go short in droughts and under competition from other species and so on. So the small populations of human beings for millions of years that lived in the old world, that's the only place they were in, for a couple of million years actually, threw everything they had at the environment, developing more and more ingenuity as they went along. But as part of this, they were also developing a capacity to understand the environment deeply and to cherish it and to try to find security within it, and actually to love, I believe, to love aspects of the natural world. How else to explain why more people go to zoos every year or to national parks than attend professional sports games? How else to explain why people will pay enormous sums to live on the seashore, and so on? So there is this mixture of emotions about the environment, which unfortunately is beginning to tip toward the rapaciousness, because of two circumstances. One is the overpopulation of the world, so that 80% of the world living in developing countries tends to be forced into destroying the environment around them just to stay alive from day to day, and also urbanization. Now more than half the people in the world and developing countries live in cities or large towns, and they are removed from the natural world and do not have a sense of what's out there and how they might relate to it personally.
Hmm. How do you have some thought about how that trend might be changed, reversed, modified? You know, particularly when it still seems to be that an awful lot of people around the world look to the industrialized world as the model, with the desire for the level of consumption and standard living that we enjoy, which certainly is not sustainable. When you think about the kind of resources are consumed, that energy is consumed, that waste is produced, that's certainly not sustainable on a global level. And yet, that seems to be what a lot of people are looking to as the ideal.
I think you've just stated the big, the central social and economic
Professor
problem of the
Wilson,
21st century.
I think we have lost the guest.
What? Say again.
Oh, hello? I'm sorry. I think for a second there, we just lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hope that wasn't my telephone. Are we back on now?
Yes, sir. Yes,
yeah,
we're back.
Okay, well, let's pick up the thread. I just said you just stated what I think is a central problem, a social and economic problem of the 21st century. And more economists and social scientists, and not just natural scientists, are waking up to it. And it goes something like this. The ecological footprint term that now I think is very useful to know about and know the measure of is the amount of land, productive land, that the average person, say in a city or a country or the world as a whole, uses for food, to get food, water, habitation, transportation, waste management, government buildings, and so on. The average amount of productive land, that is the ecological footprint of a person in the developing world, is about 1 acre. In the United States, it's 12 acres. And quite simply, the estimates, I think they're quite reliable, show that in order for the whole world, including all the people in the developing world, to come up to U.S. standard of living, which are all trying to do, with present technology, would require two more planet Earths. In other words, it cannot be done. It's the attempt to do it in the developing countries is what's destroying the environment. This is the dilemma that we have to solve. There has to be a combination of change in ethic so that Americans and others in the developed world, industrialized nations, see that it's in the long-term interest of the globe and of themselves to begin reducing the footprint. It doesn't mean they have to reduce their standard of living. It means that we should be directing more of our technological and scientific effort to providing quality life with less consumption and more preservation of non-renewable resources, including the natural environment. And moreover, we should be transferring that knowledge and the through aid and through venture capital investment to developing countries so that we can close the gap a bit while bringing down the size of the footprint overall. And certainly reducing population growth has got to be a key element in that as a global effort.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. And maybe also I should mention that I misspoke when I said that Professor Wilson's talk here was a Millercom lecture. It's not. And my apologies for any toes that I might have stepped on here. But again, I do want to mention that he will be on the campus, will be giving a talk, and certainly there will be the opportunity for people to hear him and hear more of his ideas on this subject. So we'll see if we can get that information straight for you before we finish up. Of course, again, anybody's welcome to join the conversation. You have a question, comment, you can call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So let's go to Urbana for a caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
I've got a comment and a question. I'll try to be succinct. I've been in high school classes, and I've tried to kind of probe their tendency toward technology and to evaluating technology in terms of the environment. And what I've used in the past has been a book review of a book based on the first automobile journey, the first real one, which happened in 1888 in Germany. The wife of the founder of Mercedes-Benz took a motor wagon on a 60-mile trip in 1888, and they had to stop at pharmacies to get their fuel, and they had to get people to replace the brakes on her motor wagon and so on. And I'd ask these high school students, you know, knowing what you know now, if you could be transported back to that time, knowing that half the country is covered in concrete, all the people that die every year, the way we go to wars over oil and all of that, would you still, you know, encourage the Benzes to go ahead with their, you know, automobile project? And something like 95% say they would. They just don't. You know, they don't think the negative consequences have been, you know, overwhelmed the increase in their capabilities, you know, in their daily capabilities to go from place to place and have new experiences and so on. That's my first comment. Well, that's my comment, but I have a question too. And basically, it's that, you know, I kind of understand what they're. I tend to understand what they're saying, especially when you think of people talking about like mass extinctions in the ancient past, where like 30% of the species died off, and yet everything, the planet managed to bounce back. And since you started out by talking about chemistry, that put to my mind that maybe the real difference is that and the thing that makes me think about this is that I saw this video, or I saw on TV recently, a history of drugs, and they were saying that the ancients could handle drugs, including addictive drugs, better because they had a spiritual, you know, they surrounded it with spirituality, but also because the purity of the drugs was so much less, and that chemistry has allowed us to have such pure drugs now. And that's one of the reasons why we abuse them. And I'm just wondering, in terms of chemistry, do you think that given that mass extinctions have happened in the past and all that, do you think the real problem is that chemistry is pushing us in directions that we will not be able to bounce back from? Is it the major culprit, do you think?
that's a lot of topics you covered there. Well, I certainly agree that the purification of drugs has certainly enhanced addiction by those drugs, and their availability, of course. Certainly in the past, they were used routinely, and sometimes they were used only with during special rites, or by shamans or priests to generate sacred dreams of communion with the gods. And in fact, that's probably the way a lot of religion originated, of religious mythology, is from the dreams, drugs-induced dreams of the shamans. The extinction, I don't think that drugs are driving toward extinction. I don't believe that humanity is suicidal, but I do think that we're making an awful lot of trouble for ourselves, and we're also impoverishing the world unnecessarily. And we'll find a way, one way or the other, but we want to get through that bottleneck that we're entering in this century of reducing populations, growth, reducing the population size eventually, and getting a decent standard of living, and preserving as much of the natural environment as we can. We're going to get through it, but we want to figure out a way to get through it with a minimum of damage to everything. And we haven't really given thought to that, have we? That brings to mind very nice story that you just gave about asking students to think of an alternative future out of 1888 and having, what, 95%. Can't imagine it. Well, that's the point. They can't imagine it because our leading thinkers, who appear to be public philosophers, who make the opinions, have the most influence, appear to be largely graduates in law and government and some of the social sciences, with no perception really of what the real world is in terms of the techno-scientific future that we have, or the state of the world's environment, the real world. And so our intellectuals have let us down badly by not trying to develop a better alternative for those kids or for their parents. And if we had alternatives before us, we knew the full extent of the problem, as a public as a whole, knew the whole extent, if we had a good portion of our scientific and technological genius directed toward solving it, then I think those kids would respond entirely differently. They would know what the alternatives were, and they would know how those alternatives would lead to the avoidance of the problems that are really extremely serious and potentially dangerous.
I hope you're right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left this morning in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Edward O. Wilson from Harvard University. He will be on the U of I campus next week, and let me just pass on some information to you, or not next week, but the week after next. His visit is sponsored by a number of different departments on the campus, and he will be giving three and I assume that these are public talks, then anybody who would like to attend is welcome. The McLeod Lecture, this will be on Monday the 18th, will take place at Smith Music Hall at 7:30, I presume that's 7:30 in the evening. And then a couple of talks in connection with the Klein Symposium. He'll be speaking at the Beckman Institute Tuesday the 19th at 7:30, and then the 20th, Wednesday, at the Illini Union, 10:30 in the morning. So there will be some opportunities for people in and around Champaign-Urbana, if they would like to hear more from our guest, to do that. And then, of course, I also should mention one more time that if you're interested in reading some of these ideas, you can find them outlined in his most recent book, which is titled Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge, and it is now available in a paperback edition. It's published by Vintage. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll try to accommodate everybody in the time that remains. We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our next caller is in Bloomington, Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
I certainly agree with much of what you said, particularly about the population growth. But how do you deal with the problem of religions that will not accept the idea of so-called artificial birth control?
That's the question. Yeah. I'm inclined to think that religious belief has little to do anymore with population growth. For example, Italy, which certainly is primarily Catholic and has which still has a natalist doctrine opposed to birth control, or at least not in any manner promoting it, has the lowest population and growth rate of any nation in the world, I believe it is. It's about 1.2 children per woman. They are descending quickly into negative population growth. That's Italy. And the evidence from around the world suggests that what really counts is the education and the freedom and the opportunities of women. The more those are improved, the faster the population rate of growth comes down, regardless of the ideology. So if you want to see countries in which there's still runaway population growth, you look to societies in which women are still treated as property, and that is many of the Muslim countries, of course, many of the African countries, conspicuously so, and where you want to see the rate dropping drastically, look at some of the Latin American countries, as for example Mexico now,
yes,
and Thailand, which is already at a level comparable to developed countries, and then you will see what appears to be to really count. Women, once they have any access to education whatsoever, any understanding of what the situation is, and any sense of that they might be able to control their own reproduction, by overwhelming majority in these developing countries opt for fewer children. They frequently like to talk about one or two children and a better life for their whole family.
You said that Mexico is improving. Well, how about the rest?
Its birth rate is dropping. Oh yeah, well it was horrendously high for 10 years ago, 10-20 years ago, but now I don't have the figures, but it's coming down.
How about the rest of Latin America?
What? I think it's occurring throughout Latin America at different rates. The reason why you're still getting explosive population growth in many of the Latin American countries is the same why you have it in developing countries on even if the rate is dropping. And that is, of course, the overshoot due to the fact that in most of these countries, more than half the population is under 21. In other words, these countries are just coming out of, or some of them are still in it, a period of extremely rapid or high reproduction rate. 3, 4, 5, 6 children per woman. At the same time, that mortality, that is per capita death rate, is dropping. So the result is an overshoot and of young people. And therefore, even if all of the young generation coming along now, the teenagers, have only 2 children, say they're at 0 population growth, the population will continue to grow for another several decades.
Well, you seem to be a little more sanguine about it than I am, sir. But
oh, no, well, you have to be optimistic. There isn't any alternative.
No.
All right.
I agree, but thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Chicago for someone else here. Line number 1. Hello.
Yes, to heal the planet most effectively and expeditiously, a book by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute called Natural Capitalism speak about creating the next industrial revolution, which will address the matter of ecosystem degradation and what can be implemented along the lines that you were previously discussing in the talk today. So I highly recommend that book by Amory Lovins and others who contributed to it, Natural Capitalism, and another book called Mid-Course Correction Toward a Sustainable Enterprise, in which they view the Earth, instead of being a spaceship, sort of like a carpet. When you spoke about mankind's having a footprint everywhere he's tread, well, just like a carpet, it wears out here and there, and we have to replace certain sectors, but why do it at the cost of virgin and still unspoiled territory? Why not recycle and continue to use what we have more expeditiously? So I do recommend those things. But I have one question to ask you on a view on cloning, because when we talk about diversity, up comes the jack-in-the-box called cloning, and on the other hand, euthanasia.
Well, first of all, let me say the books you mentioned are part of a very large library that provides us with low-tech and high-tech methods for turning the economy around. It's just that so very few people read them. We need, and we have whole think tanks now devoted to this, but we have not yet reached the authors of books of this nature, which many of which are excellent. For example, the entire World Watch Institute series, World Watch papers and publications are another example. If I were to direct any person to a library to read up on the state of the world and what can be done about it issue by issue, I would send them the World Watch series and a good library. But the problem is that this hasn't gotten through yet.
Yes.
To our intellectual leaders, to our political leaders, and to a public that is in a kind of a state of denial, and this is why education and political activity in this area is so important. I don't worry about cloning.
Well, okay.
To me, it's a minor issue.
To try to get them on the show. Thank you.
All right. Well, and I think we're just about at the point that we're going to have to stop. I wonder, Professor Wilson, the ideas that you have been writing about for some time now, and you write about consilience, seem to, you know, have been following down a particular kind of road. Do you think that, I'm afraid I'm asking this question rather badly, have you sort of laid out the ideas or that you have, and is that it? Have you come to the conclusion, or are there some further steps that along this line that you have yet to take and are going to provide
a lot of them? I'd like another hour to talk to you, but we're running out of time. And I just would say that not only is there a growing body of technology and expertise ready to move, and as soon as the political will is there, the level of education allows it, but also there are encouraging signs. One of the most encouraging is in the global conservation organizations. I'm on the board of directors of several of them, and they are acquiring muscle in the way of substantial donations from private individuals and corporations in a manner that is beginning to affect policy in some of the developing countries. And so there are some favorable signs, and the reason I am optimistic is that sometimes, given enough pressure, witness the Berlin Wall, enough evolution, things can turn around very quickly.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest, Edward O. Wilson from Harvard University. And if you would like to read more again of his thinking on the subject we've been discussing, look for his recent book, Consilience. It's now available in a paperback edition published by Vintage. And also, he will be giving some talks on the U of I campus the week of October 18th. So there is the opportunity for some people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana to hear more from him then.